Well, do you want to do this thing?
Let's do it.
Okay.
Yeah, you feel pumped? You sound pumped.
Not at all. I don't at all feel pumped, but...
I think we can bring some false glamour, though.
Yep.
Like, yep. Smiles, everyone. It's showtime.
And you know, sometimes you can't wait around for inspiration to strike. You just need to talk about whatever we have to talk about this week. So
I think it is, again, the appropriate amount of inspiration based on what we have read.
Yeah. So, yep. I think we're matching the energy that the issues brought to us. So... All right. Well, with that all said, let's roll this thing. Hey there, and welcome to episode number 174 of Marvel by the Month, the podcast that takes you through the history of Marvel Comics one month at a time. In this episode, that month is March 1972. My name is Brian Stratton.
Mine is Rob Milne.
And I'm Jamie Wenger.
So last week, we talked about four milestone issues that came out in March of 1972 with our friends from the Comics Canon. We talked about Submariner number 50, Avengers number 100, Captain America 150, and Thor number 200.
Hey, I remember some of those.
Yeah, they were, they certainly had some round numbers yes. in their issue numbers.
Color.
Yep.
So many colors.
Yeah.
The whole spectrum of human sight was embedded in the very tissue of the fabric of the manifest of the destiny of those comics.
Sounds like a review of Morbius that we recently shared.
Yes.
They were I assume they were originally on paper. I was reading them with a light behind them from a screen with pages.
Yeah, whatever you say about them, you can't say that they were not comic books that came out in March of 1972.
That's true. Read.
Yep, they all contain between 20 and 23 pages of story, and we certainly did talk about them. But this week, we're going to talk about the rest of the non-reprint superhero comics that came out this month, with one exception. We are really dragging this month out.
Yeah, and it's not the month to do that to, but it's just how it's shaking out.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not the month for the quality of comics, I should say, although the last holdout is something special.
Yes, it certainly is.
I'm completely in the dark. I have no idea. No,
okay.
I take these as they come a week at a time. So
yeah, you're going to be so surprised.
I like that you're living in the eternal now.
That's me.
Very in the moment.
I don't have time for planning.
Nope.
there's no way you could possibly look ahead on the sheet to see what we were doing.
Virtually impossible.
Yeah. Well, anyway, so before we start talking about the Marvel Comics of March 1972, let's get a little historical context for what was going on in the world of March 1972. Rob, we're going to need you to start us off with some comics news.
Comics news. One month after losing the Tarzan comic book license, Gold Key published the first issue of Brothers of the Spear, which had been an original backup feature in the company's Tarzan book. Speaking of Tarzan, starting with issue number 46, DC begins publishing Korak, Son of Tarzan, maintaining Gold Key's numbering.
Mm-hmm.
Marvel launched a new World War II era war comic, Combat Kelly, which ran for 9 issues and ended with almost the entire cast being murdered by Nazis.
Whoa.
Marvel also had one more milestone issue that we didn't talk about last episode, Rawhide Kid number 100, which featured a 14-page original story by Larry Lieber and George Roussos, a reprint of a 6-page story by John Buscema from 1950, and absolutely no mention of its triple-digit status on the cover.
It's so weird how they completely undersell so many of these, what would be like big marketing opportunities now.
Like hyping them up. I did see a mention in one of the books, the back of the Iron Man book that we're talking about today. There was a mention of Rawhide Kid.
Yes.
And that it was a big number.
Yeah.
But it was sort of after the fact, and it was probably already on stands.
Yeah. And a third of the book was just an old reprint.
Yeah.
You know, it's just very strange.
I guess I'm probably overthinking it, but is there any chance that the reason they weren't putting emphasis on the what we would call round numbers is because the issues come out monthly?
Mm-hmm.
So tens and 100, like your base 10 milestones aren't that it's like base 12 would be the more interesting thing. So like, issue 120 or yeah, 120 would be 10 years of the comic.
Right, right.
I think so. Maybe that's what's going to happen is that at issue 120, all these are just going to be the most fabulous epic.
Wait, so
triple size.
The podcast is weekly. So should we go on 52?
Base 52. Yeah.
Base 50. That's the only, yeah, that's the only thing that makes sense.
I love all of that.
Yeah.
Sounds like my normal brain. And yes, you're overthinking it.
Yeah. I just get the feeling that it's just, for whatever reason, they didn't recognize it as a big deal. And I think part of it is because, I mean, at the time, comics would change titles so frequently. Thor is, it just has the Journey into Mystery numbering, right? So it's not even like there were 200 issues of Thor. There were 200 issues of the publication that Thor became.
Thor eventually was a backup in and then the front of and then named after.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And same thing with Captain America. Like it, you know, that numbering just picked up at issue 100. And when it took over Tales to Astonish. Yeah. Tales to Astonish.
It was like, is it Tales of Suspense?
Tales to Astonish or of Suspense?
I can't remember.
I think. Yeah.
I think it's of Suspense because there was Iron Man and Cap in there for a while.
Yes. So, yep.
Which has nothing to do with either of them. Like, Suspense is not what either of them
do.
Should be in.
No. Yeah. Not at all.
They do know Suspense.
Yeah. Okay. So I think the short answer is they don't make a big deal out of round number issue numbers because it's not a big deal. Because it's just like, it just happened to be, it's like, well, this is the month that that one came out, but it doesn't mean that. I mean, like Fantastic Four and Spider-Man are kind of a different story because
I feel like they tried with Avengers, like
they certainly tried.
They went in on that one thinking we're going to make a big deal and every Avengers is going to show up, and then they did what they did.
Yeah,
and they ran out of time.
Yeah,
and Manny Hands helped out.
Yeah, but until you have a foil embossed die cut cover, like you're not even trying, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, agreed.
I need a hologram. Last comic news on March 4th, Charles Biro, the Golden Age comics artist, editor and writer known for Airboy, the original Daredevil, and the seminal 1940s and 50s crime comic Crime Does Not Pay, passed away at the age of 60. Did I get his name right?
Yep, Charles Biro. Mm-hmm.
Who is reading Crime Does Not Pay? That sounds like not a cool kid.
It was a super violent crime comic. It was like the first crime comic. It was the thing that kind of inspired the EC
Sin City
comics. Well, I mean, yeah, ultimately, but
every noir after.
Yeah, but like all the violent crime comics that EC published, and then which led them to doing the horror comics. It you can all trace it back to Crime Does Not Pay. So
Is that kind of like a misdirect? Like you couldn't have Crime Definitely Pays as your cover.
Let's do crimes.
Yeah. Let's do crimes.
Jamie, you want to talk about some other history stuffs?
Certainly. On March 2nd, the Student Senate at Stanford University voted 18-4 to accept the recommendation that the school's athletic team drop the nickname Stanford Indians. Other college and high school teams would follow, retiring other Native American-inspired mascots. That's
so wait, cool. you mean that's not something that this woke culture just decided to start doing like within the last 5 to 10 years? But this is something that like people have actually been concerned about for a very long time?
Well, I mean, hippies at Stanford, come on. Trying to speak to the, catch some more of that audience that we are really looking for.
Right.
Yeah.
That super lucrative, super racist audience.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, maybe this will help. on the 3rd of March, 1972, after more than 48 years, the carving of the Boss Relief sculpture on Stone Mountain near Atlanta, Georgia, was completed under the direction of Walker Hancock. The 90-foot-high representation of Jefferson Davis, Robert E. Lee, and Stonewall Jackson had been started on June 23rd, 1923 by Gutzon Borglum, which I'm almost positive is an orc.
I think Borglum might have been involved in Mount Rushmore, though, too.
Really?
Yeah. I read a book by Dan Simmons called Black Hills. It's about the creation of, it's a great historical fiction book, but about the creation of Mount Rushmore, and that name rings a bell.
Borglum.
Yeah. I mean, it just sounds like a goblin burped, but yeah. okay. on the 6th of March, 1972, we have Beatles by the Month.
What?
Yeah. United States immigration authorities revoked the visa of John Lennon. The Nixon administration said Lennon had been admitted to the country improperly because he had pleaded guilty to a misdemeanor charge of cannabis possession in London in 1968. And immigration law at the time banned the admission of anyone convicted of any drug offense. So they retroactively kicked him out with 60 days to vacate the states.
What?
Yeah.
Wow. Is that still like that? That's not still like that, right?
No. Obama used this very case to help forward the legalization of cannabis. Later.
Thanks a lot,
much
Obama.
Later. Thanks, yeah. Obama. For reals.
On March 8th, President Nixon issued Executive Order 11652, setting standards for top secret, and confidential classifications of government documents, as well as a schedule of declassification. EO 11652 was superseded by the orders of later American presidents, and classified information is now governed by Executive Order 13292.
So there is a system for classifying and declassifying documents that even presidents are supposed to adhere to.
Huh.
Interesting.
So you probably couldn't become president and like not know that, right? That seems like that's like 101, right?
It seems highly unlikely. I'm sure someone would try to explain it to you at least.
Yeah. It would be treasonous if someone did try to explain it to you and then you did it anyway. Those rules. But
right, yeah, that would be a pretty obvious. Yeah. You would know who would do that. That'd be crazy.
Yeah. I mean, but a tyrant might. Mm. I don't know.
Oh, yeah. Hypothetical. Yeah.
So some sort of like comic book supervillain president.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. On March 12th, 1972, Gordie Howe's number 9 jersey was retired by the Detroit Red Wings, and Bill Russell's number 6 was retired by the Boston Celtics. Bill Russell was the greatest basketball player in history, and he recently passed away, but he is he was the winningest player and coach in basketball history, and just like an incredible figure in Boston sports and basketball in general. So,
oh, whoa.
Yeah.
I even remember that name from following basketball when I was a kid.
Yeah.
On the 15th of March, The Godfather, a movie you probably never heard of, directed by Francis Ford Coppola, debuted in 5 cinemas in New York City and would set a record, which stood until 1975, for the highest grossing film in history, taking in $87,500,000 in its first release.
Wow. Whoa.
Man, you could buy a country. Like, you could buy an island for that amount of money today.
You could buy a full scene of a Marvel movie.
Right. And, you know, I really think of The Godfather, and I think Coppola would agree. I think of The Godfather really as maybe the first superhero movie. I think he'd agree with that.
I'd subscribe to your TED Talk.
I'd like to talk to him about that.
Yeah. Francis, come on the show.
On March 18th, alleged comedian Dane Cook, who had to apologize for publicly revealing that he auditioned for the role of Captain America in 2010, was born in Boston, Massachusetts. Snuck that in there, huh?
I love it when I just type things into the notes that you don't look at before you start reading.
Yeah, I'm like I'm like Will Ferrell in Anchorman. It's just like whatever's in there, that's what I'm going to say.
Just read whatever's on the prompter. On the 22nd of March, the proposed Equal Rights Amendment was approved by the United States Senate 84-8 after passing the House on October 12th, 354-23, and was sent to the states to consider ratification. Although 35 states ratified the amendment by the original 1979 deadline, which was later extended to 1982, the ERA fell short of the 38 states required for approval.
Ugh.
Which just, it blows my mind that, like, I mean, you have it being overwhelmingly cleared by the Senate and House, and then it just winds up not getting ratified. Like, that's wild.
Yeah. That seems like the system not working properly.
Yeah.
Like when it's that clear that that's what everybody wants, kind of.
Yeah. But we fixed that. The same day, the Schaefer Commission, formerly the National Commission on Marijuana and Drug Abuse, unanimously recommended the removal of federal and state restrictions against the personal possession and private use of marijuana.
What?
The commission's surprising conclusions were not accepted by President Nixon or by Congress.
He was just like, nope, sorry, no, nope.
No.
Yeah.
No.
That's ridiculous. Yep. Why did he bother paying for the thing in the first place?
I don't know. It was a congressional committee, too. Like, Congress convened the committee, and they just then ignored their unanimous recommendation.
Oh, my gosh. Yep. That's stupid.
Well, because otherwise, how are you going to be able to just conveniently lock up black people and hippies?
And kick John Lennon out of your country.
Right, exactly.
For singing, you know, Give Peace a Chance
right.
at rallies.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
That's why they made crack, right? Like, that was the whole point of crack.
Yep.
Yeah. Quite possibly.
Yes. Yeah, I'm going to say yes. Yes, it was.
And also on that same day, the United States Supreme Court ruled in Einstadt versus Baird that unmarried people had the same rights to contraceptive products as married people did. The ruling struck down a Massachusetts law and extended the protection of the 1965 ruling in Griswold versus Connecticut.
Yep. On the 24th of March, Edward Heath, Prime Minister of the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland, announced direct rule from London after half a century of Northern Irish autonomy. The bicameral Parliament of Northern Ireland, commonly referred to as Stormont, was suspended, and Prime Minister of Northern Ireland Brian Faulkner was replaced by William Whitelaw, named to the newly created post of Secretary of State for Northern Ireland. So no home rule.
And then I stuck in Metal by the Month. The 25th of March, Deep Purple's Machine Head, a 7-track album, was released. It started with Highway Star and ended with Space Truckin', and it slowly climbed up the charts into the top 40. The release of Smoke on the Water, which was also on it as a single in May of 1973, sent the LP into the Billboard 200. And it's a seminal heavy metal album.
Sure. Yeah.
And that's probably the great, excellent track Machine Head by Bush comes from. It was probably inspired by this very album.
It could have been, unfortunately so. on the 27th of March, the comic strip Funky Winkerbean made its debut, introduced by King Features Syndicate.
Funky Winkerbean.
Funky Winkerbean. The author was Tom Batiuk, a 24-year-old art teacher at Eastern Heights Junior High School in Elyria, Ohio. I don't know how to spell it.
It's close enough.
Ohio.
Elyria. Cool. That sounds like a great place to go. On that same day, MC Escher died at age 73 in Hilversum, Netherlands.
Mm-hmm.
And his remains were confusing.
They were thrown on stairs going up walls and doors that opened into nothing.
He was both dead and
like
undead.
Birds, but also hands at the same time. It's very confusing.
On the 29th of March, for the first time since 1966, authorities in East Germany opened the Berlin Wall for an 8-day period in order to allow visitors from West Germany during the Easter holidays, and tens of thousands of Westerners received permission to travel to East Berlin.
Cool.
For the first time since 1952, the communist government permitted visitors to go beyond the capital and into the countryside as well.
Ooh.
Whoa. There must be cool books about that.
I would imagine, yeah.
On that same day, the Equal Rights Amendment was rejected by Oklahoma.
What? There we go. Yep.
The vote in the state's House of Representatives was rejected by Oklahoma after being ratified by the first 7 states to vote on it. The vote in the state's House of Representatives was 52-36, 7 short of the necessary 2/3 majority. The anti-ERA movement, led by conservative activist Phyllis Schlafly, began receiving support in other states.
Yeah.
What? Look, not to endorse the Patriot Act, but like, how do you vote against something called the Equal Rights Act? You gotta feel like a real jerk. Just the name. You don't want that?
Yeah.
Am I so progressive and that I can't even fathom?
You can't even fathom not wanting people to have the same rights. That's just crazy talk.
Yeah. Well, if everyone has the same rights, then I won't have as many.
I won't have special rights.
It's a zero-sum game. We can't just let everyone have rights, because then no one will have rights.
Yeah, but maybe the rights are spread further, so they're more valuable.
That sounds like Star Trek crap.
Yeah, sounds
I get that
socialist to me.
I do too.
On March 31st, a team of investigators from the Flamingo Park Zoo in Scarborough found a mysterious carcass floating in Scotland's Loch Ness. While searching for proof of the existence of the legendary Loch Ness monster and loaded it into their truck. They were stopped by Fife police under a 1933 law prohibiting the removal of unidentified creatures from the loch, and the incident made headlines worldwide. An examination determined that the body was that of an elephant seal which had died the week before at Flamingo Park. John Shields, a zoo employee, had intended only to play a joke on his colleagues and hadn't counted on police or press attention.
That's a pretty funny joke.
Take a dead seal and throw it into a lake.
Hear me out.
Any practical joke that involves a carcass, that's a laugh riot.
That's like murder being the ultimate prank, you know?
Right.
I mean, when you think about it.
It is.
Yeah.
Also, like that in 1933, there was a law preventing the removal of unidentified creatures. Like it was happening so often that they needed a law to prevent it. What was going on over there?
And allegedly, Nessie could walk, you know, was essentially a brontosaurus or, you know, a small version. I mean, I did a lot of reading of this when I was a kid. And then I also assumed Nessie was like a log.
Okay.
So I wonder if the law was basically just like a PR stunt.
Yeah.
Saying it's like, tourism. No, you're not allowed to kidnap Nessie from our lock because she definitely lives there.
I think places like Cougar, Washington have like a can't shoot Bigfoot laws, things like that.
Right. Oh, really?
Yeah.
Hmm. No, that's just because, I mean, so many of their citizens have been mistaken.
I've been shot at least 4 times exactly. While camping around there.
All right. Well, that's some of what was happening in the world of March 1972. We're going to take a quick break. When we return, we're going to talk about some of the Marvel comics of March 1972 right here on Marvel by the Month. Hey everyone, this show is 100% ad-free and supported by listeners like you who subscribe to our Patreon at patreon.com/marvelbythemonth. Our Patreon supporters make it possible for us to make Marvel by the Month week in and week out. And look, we love all of our listeners, but we love our Patreon subscribers just a little bit more.
That's why anyone who supports us at the $4 a month level gets instant access to the 60 extended and exclusive episodes in our bonus feed. Those bonus episodes feature more deep dives and longer conversations with your favorite guests that you just don't get in the public feed.
For less than a dollar an episode, you get extended versions that are 20, 30, sometimes even 60 minutes longer than the public versions.
We've been so fortunate to get some of the most interesting nerds in the world to talk about weird old Marvel comics with us. I'm talking about folks like Elliot Kalin, Brian Michael Bendis, Tom Brevoort, Steve Bissett, Sean Baby, Katie Pride, Chelsea Kane, Mark Evanier, and more.
A lot of work goes into making this show week in and week out. When you support us at patreon.com/marvelbythemonth, you are helping to make this show happen.
Yeah, it's basically a part-time job, and we're the sort of selfish jerks who wouldn't mind getting paid just a little bit for doing that. I mean, if it's okay for you. I didn't mean to overstep here. I apologize.
Yeah, way to give him the hard sell, Jamie. patreon.com/marvelbythemonth is where to go to support Marvel by the Month and access all of our past, present, and future subscriber exclusive content.
Welcome back to Marvel by the Month. Let's talk about Amazing Spider-Man number 100, titled Enter Doctor Strange. But there's a semi.
I mean, there's some consent issues there to probably discuss.
It's written by Stan Lee, art by John Romita. Our story begins with a Ditko-esque Peter Parker-ian assemblage of floating heads around Pete. I think the assemblage noun should be an anguish of floating heads.
Ooh, I like that. I love it.
Because they are, as usual, demonstrating Peter's inner torment. The heads in question are Flash's, Gwen's, and the unknown giant with the team from Vietnam.
Mm-hmm. And also, shout out Artie Simek for the lettering on this page, where he uses, I think, eight nine different shapes of captions and balloons.
Yeah, I was going to say there's so many. I mean, Stan has so much to catch you up on here, and it's all in different colors and shapes, and it looks like somebody just went to town in a PowerPoint. I mean, still, it looks way better than that, but I just mean of all the shapes of these captions. There's like arrow, circle, you know, burst. Yep. Pete just fought the Vietnamese team who were kidnapping Flash, and he lost. That kind of catches you up. And they grabbed Flash to make him pay.
But you did
for
that without using 6,000 words.
Yeah, I'm going to use more. They grabbed Flash to make him pay for the destruction of a hidden temple and the death of the high priest there when Flash was in Vietnam.
Right.
Then they blew up a chunk of the building that they were in and escaped with Flash. Peter can't go after them because Gwen has accused him of being a coward again and running off whenever there's trouble. Pete did get a Spidey tracer on them, though. The other news is Pete had to fight in his civvies because he didn't have time or privacy to switch into the spider suit. He stuck to the darkness but left his shoes in the hallway where a cop found them later. And for, I think, the fourth time that I can remember in Spider-Man comics, Peter says that his shoes got blown off in the explosion.
Yeah.
I just love that that's his go-to. I must have got blown out of my shoes.
You know, that's also a very funny Dane Cook routine, Brian.
But the thing that's also like, I mean, once again, Peter is going to elaborate lengths to explain a situation that no one is asking him about.
Right.
You know, like if anything, it's suspicious that you are working this hard to explain this thing.
Right.
That no one cares about.
Yep.
This is pretty much the Peter Parker MO, but yeah. So how will he get away and after Flash without leaving and making Gwen think he's cowardly? He goes to wash up, switches to the Spider-Man costume, and then makes a web dummy with his street clothes again. Then Spider-Man kidnaps Web Parker and swings away saying, "Relax, I'm not going to hurt this clown. I just want to ask him a few questions."
Yeah, because it's better to have the love of your life be in mortal terror about what is happening to you because you've been abducted by a dangerous vigilante than it is for her to think that you're a coward because you disappear when there's danger.
Right. Just re-traumatize, trigger Gwen, who thinks that still isn't sure that Spider-Man didn't kill her dad.
Yeah.
So Spidey, you know, swings away. Peter solved the problem. Dumps the web dummy and heads after his tracer, which leads him to Greenwich Village, and the signal is stronger than it's ever been.
Did you guys read, I think it was probably like mid to late 90s, that dummy has a whole spinoff series. I think it runs about 50 issues.
It's Rob Liefeld.
Yeah. That's exactly what I was picturing.
Well, the great thing about it is you don't have to draw the feet.
He does have some shoes on that, but which also I was just thinking of Peter in that bathroom trying to like get the web fluid into the pants and all the kind of,
oh gosh, that's
its own sitcom.
Also in the bathroom, I don't want to call Peter out here, but he puts his shoes on the bathroom counter. Like, where was this kid raised?
I mean, was that sort of thing more acceptable in the 70s? Were the grounds
cleaner? No, it was never acceptable. You don't put your shoes on surfaces.
He walked in there wearing, or is he carrying them? Ew,
he's carrying them. Why didn't he put them on his feet? That's where shoes belong.
So Spidey's in Greenwich Village with the spider sense is just going off the charts with the tracer, but it turns out that it led him to the invisible astral form of Doctor Strange, which I didn't know was totally invisible because people have seen it. But it was to him. So the doctor leads Spidey by triggering his spider sense and by voice to the Sanctum Sanctorum and the doctor's physical form. And it turns out, of course, there is magic afoot. And it involves the Vietnamese group and the kidnapping of Flash Thompson. What are the chances? We learn that the high priest is not dead, but entranced. The plan is the monks from the temple, that's the this group, are going to sacrifice Flash so that his life essence will restore the high priest to life.
Right.
Pretty simple.
Mm-hmm.
And that's like standard temple behavior, right? Like you're in an enlightened temple, so you're going to do some murders to bring back temple people.
Super enlightened. But then also,
it seems to be implied pretty strongly that this is just something they believe. This isn't like actual Doctor Strange magic. Like,
right.
That they're just like, yeah, we're pretty sure if we kill you, he'll come back to life. So we're going to give that a try.
Yeah. We'll feel better. Shashan is with them. She was the girl who befriended Flash when he was hurt, when he was serving and found the temple. But even though she knows Flash is not guilty, she just keeps going along with the whole vengeance plan. As Strange and Spidey head to find Flash, Shashan sneaks into the room Flash is being held captive in. She recounts meeting Flash and his innocence, but then draws a knife as though to kill him.
Mm-hmm.
But she's interrupted by one of the monks. Suddenly, we check in on Gwen, who is letting Harry know what's happened to Peter. Harry's trying to stop her from explaining anything. And it turns out that Aunt May had dropped by, so Aunt May hears it too.
Well, she dropped by because her and Harry have a thing going on.
Yeah.
Oh,
right. Remember? Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
It's canonical at this point.
That's true. So she's there for her pick me up, and
whoa, because she's so light, you see.
Right. Her and Harry are just trying to get each other through some tough times. It's not, I mean, it's just for now. It's not a long-term thing.
No, and they know that. You know, it's clear.
Yeah.
There's not a future in it for either one of them.
No.
May's like 50. She just looks like she's 120.
She's either 50 or 150.
Right.
Yeah.
But May is, of course, distraught about her boy. And Gwen just loses it and yells at May that Peter is a man now, not a boy.
The
man that Gwen loves. Which prompts May to say, perhaps a foolish old lady, lonely and unthinking, can smother a person with love.
And now she's thinking about, it's like, after Gwen leaves, maybe I can smother Harry with love.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. That scene, if you think about it in real life, is like tremendously upsetting. Like this vulnerable old woman with love is getting screamed at by like the beautiful woman who's taking away her child.
Yeah.
Like it like can read very painfully.
Yes.
It's rough, but it's nice to see May kind of realize that she may have been smothering Peter, although Peter's been gaslighting her forever. So
yeah. Would you say she's been smothering him?
Yeah.
Okay.
But I mean, I also,
an honest question.
Yeah, no, I mean, but I also think he hasn't been pushing back against it either, you know? So like she still treats him like a child.
Codependent relationship.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Yep. It's a utterly dysfunctional relationship in some ways, and I don't blame Gwen for being intensely frustrated.
Right,
by it.
Right.
She just thought maybe her boyfriend got exploded too. She's had a rough, and then abducted, definitely abducted by Spider-Man.
Yeah.
Scoundrel. Right. Yeah. So back to the monks and the time for the sacrifice. Of course, Doctor Strange and Spidey show up just in time. Doc makes all their weapons disappear with a little spell, flames of the Faltine.
And when their entrance is, so the monks are about to execute Flash, and one of them says, "For it is written, a life for a life." And then Doctor Strange shows up and, you know, from off panel, he says, "It is also written, thou shalt not kill." So it really is sort of like this kind of uncomfortable...
Why is Doctor Strange throwing Christian crap out there too?
See, that's the thing. It's like you have this like sort of like generic primitive culture, you know, eye for an eye kind of thing.
Yeah.
And then you have, you know, civilization is showing up with, you know, the Judeo-Christian viewpoint.
I mean, both of these are in the Old Testament, but you know.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
I do like then immediately after saying thou shalt not kill, after throwing out like a commandment, Doctor Strange starts talking about demons.
Yeah.
Or you know,
satanish.
Satanish.
Yeah. Yep.
And Demons of Darkness is like the next thing he says. So it's like, that guy is all conflicted. And he makes all of the, Satanish rhymes with vanish, like make your weapons vanish.
Yep.
I do like that his spells are starting to rhyme. It gives me a little Etrigan tingle.
Yep.
Spidey unties Flash, but is attacked by the giant monk. So he does some grade A professional wrestling, and he just does like pulls the like webs his face, gets up on his head, does the scissor thing around his neck, flips him over, all kinds of stuff.
It is pretty great. It's like classic Lucha stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Does the full flip of, you know, especially with the smaller guy to the giant guy.
Yep.
Takes him out completely.
Now the big guy's doing all the work in a move like that. Oh. So, yeah.
Don't break kayfabe. So Doc is casting a spell at the high priest, and Spidey keeps everyone at bay with copious amounts of webbing. He's just like, he puts a wall of webs up. I don't know. He just was full with web fluid that day.
Yeah. Yeah,
he brought extra. And when you he's
on salary now. He can afford to keep his web clips all stocked up.
Enough to make a web dummy, a web wall, you know, just anything. You need a web Porsche, he's going to do that. So the high priest gets restored to life because it turns out he used the wisdom of the ancients, so it is a little magic, to put himself into a trance to save him from the shelling, which I guess works. Like, just go to fall asleep so the bomb don't hit me.
Yep.
While in the trance,
it's a duck and cover thing. If you don't look directly at the blast, it can't hurt you.
Oh, makes
okay. Plus, your muscles are so relaxed in that state anyway. You know, if you get hit, it doesn't slice. It just kind of bounces.
Yeah, it's why drunk drivers always survive the crash.
Exactly. That's
every time.
For. Yep.
If only Tony had been drinking in that first issue of Iron Man, we wouldn't have Iron Man.
It's the one time he wasn't drinking.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, what? So while in the trance, the high priest sent out a mystical call for help, and of course the doctor could not fail to heed it. The high priest clears Flash of wrongdoing, and Flash tells Spidey he's off to tell Groovy Gwendy about all the craziness. So Pete gets reminded right at the last panel, as classic Stan, you know, Spider-Man, of the possible, he's solved this problem. But now he's reminded of the possible romance between Gwen and Flash, or what he suspects is a romance, and ends up just Charlie Browning, you know, head in his hand.
Christmas time is here.
And then we're promised that next will be the Grinning Gibbon.
Maybe
I'm
Stanley,
so looking forward to this.
Possibly Stanley's greatest creation. Also, I think, and I'm not 100% on this, I think next issue is Stan's last issue of Amazing Spider-Man.
Oh, whoa.
Yep.
He's going to go out with a gibbon?
He's going out with a gibbon. it's like the exact opposite of, you know, going out with a bang.
But, well, that's it. You know, I think we should maybe take a break.
I think that sounds good.
Great.
Yep. We will be back in just a minute with more of the Marvel Comics of March 1972 right here on Marvel by the Month.
All right, welcome back to Marvel by the Month. I will be taking us through Daredevil 88, Call Him Kilgrave, written by Jerry Conway, art by Gene Colan and Tom Palmer.
88, so, I'm just going to stop you right away. Should be a milestone for piano aficionados.
Or white supremacists.
Oh, well, dang. It was 88.
I mean, there's a pretty big overlap in the Venn diagram.
There are more white key. I mean,
would you
white
say
keys
that piano is the most white supremacist instrument?
And remember, this is for the record, so please do be honest.
What just happened is my brain started scanning for what is the most white supremacist. I'm like, banjo? Maybe. okay, I'm not going to come up with an answer right now.
That'll be a Patreon. They can pay extra for
pass.
Oh, boy.
We open on a very kinetic looking car chase in San Francisco with red car chasing very purple car.
Purple Black Mustang. Widow. Whoa, yeah.
Black Widow drives Red Car and wonders if Daredevil really cares for her, which very obviously he does. Purple Car has Danny French in it, a mysterious figure from her past and the past couple issues. Meanwhile, Daredevil heads to a police station to make nice with notorious hardbutt Commissioner Iron Guts O'Hara.
Hardbutt Iron Guts.
But Hardbutt Iron Guts can't lose.
But instead of actually doing that, he just ends up telling, like, they get into a fight and he's like, I'm here to stay regardless of what you say. So he doesn't really make nice.
He makes less nice than when
he's down niceness from when he entered. But the other cops in the precinct seem to really like him, which is a really nice contrast with Spider-Man. I'm always looking for ways that these two books can be more different. So back to the car chase, sort of. After having lost Purple Car, the Widow heads home to be mean to Ivan for a little while. And when Daredevil comes in, Ivan decides it's time to reveal his true connection to Natasha. But then before we get any of that, we cut to a den of bad guys talking, and there's like a lot to unpack here, kind of all close together. Mm-hmm. So whatever's going on here, they've been planning this thing for years. All the henchmen seem really enthusiastic. Kilgrave, who's in charge, he seems very relaxed, very suave, very affectionate. He's like leaning against stuff. He's crossing his legs. He's touching people's shoulders. He's just being super chill. It's like there's like a lot of character from his physical actions here, in a way that we don't always see a lot of those details.
Yeah. Also, he's not purple, which I think that's got to be a coloring oversight, right? Because he's purple on the cover.
Has he been purple in the past?
Yes, he was purple in his only other appearance.
Okay.
I believe the gas that gave him his powers turned him purple.
Yeah.
Okay.
Grape ape. Just wanted to say grape ape.
Done and done. Check.
Check. Kilgrave also has a special lady friend there named Lucy, who's also very affectionate and a little sort of double entendre-y. She seems like a cool gal. Everyone here is dressed in very, I'm going to say, quote unquote, futuristic purple and pink outfits, except for Lucy, who's in very fetching shades of complementary greens or clashing greens. I'm not sure which one, but she's just wearing all green. It's kind of like Siren's costume in the 90s, which is like accentuated even more because her arm is on a couch and there's stripes underneath it,
which looks like, the
Banshee.
It looks like the Banshee from AOA. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Then back at the house.
Or Ozzy Osbourne.
Yes.
Okay, back at the house. Sorry.
Back at the house. Ivan says he doesn't know what's up between Natasha and this French guy, but he will explain how they met, which was during World War II in Stalingrad. He caught her as a young child being thrown from a burning building. Together, they kind of lone wolf and cub it across all the borders. And eventually, like time, I guess, jumps forward here. And he enrolls her in a school where she's very smart. She's very athletic. And so she's selected for spycraft.
So he enrolls her in a school. Like, I get the feeling this will be retconned where she winds up enrolled in the Red Room.
Yeah.
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 Whether he knows it or not.
Yeah. Oh, interesting. Okay. So it's possible he did it, but didn't know it or.
Yeah.
Or she was selected from that school to be put into the Red Room.
Maybe. Know. Yeah.
But then in a single panel during spy training, she meets and marries Red Guardian, but then she's forced to leave the country and doesn't know that she's not coming back. So at this point, flashback is over. Tasha comes out of the room and says that they don't need to worry about her. She's going to handle French all by herself. And she just goes off to do that. Perpetually feminist role model and consent enthusiast Daredevil immediately ignores this and follows right after her. He tells Ivan to keep an eye on the tracking device.
Tracking device.
Yeah,
what a gentleman.
Yeah. I was wondering what tracking device and on who and if permission was given for that tracking device. They do mention it later, and it took the wind out of my sails. So
Yeah, I thought it was just on his person, so Ivan could track him. And I was like, okay, well, that seems pretty nice for a Matt Murdock move, but yep,
it's not.
So Daredevil follows her. But on the way, he decides to investigate an explosion that he saw, not because he wants to, mind you. he says he has to do it because it's like basically good for his image as the new superhero in town.
Right.
So like kind of strike one there. But then even before he helps with the explosion, he pauses to check his newly installed police radio receiver, which confirms the explosion that he just saw. And so he's like, okay, now I definitely have to help.
But it says the explosion is part a distraction for a crime. Right. So now it's crime. Okay. So now he's like, well, now I have to show up. I mean,
it's officially crime. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm not just helping people out of burning windows or something.
I'm not just helping like a dummy.
Yeah.
So then he thinks Natasha is a big girl and she can take care of herself, he progressively thinks. Kilgrave's Lavender troops are robbing what is possibly the most narrow bank I've ever seen. I was like, are they in a truck? Like, I thought maybe they were robbing a very long truck. It's a very strange perspective. The civilians here are all acting like sheep. And without will, as the most insentient amoeba, says Chico, the lead crime goon. These goons are actually given kind of a lot of personality throughout this.
Yeah.
You see a lot more of that in modern times than you do back then, but it's just like a nice dose of like pre-Claremont goons having personalities.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it felt like stormtroopers having a conversation about what they're doing after work or something.
Yeah, right. So the civilian behavior is probably due to the purple gas that they've released in here, which the goons' helmets totally protect them from, except for their totally exposed open mouths. Then Daredevil, in super classic Daredevil style, bursts through the window, but the gas is messing with his senses, so he's immediately on his knees and he's struggling to navigate, so he like really starts this fight at a deficit.
There's a great line from one of the goons. He says, "Cripes, will you look at that? The gas hit him harder than the flat side of a griddle." it's a delightfully Looney Tunes image.
Totally. Yeah, wherever Kilgrave got these guys from, it was like a really quality goon source. Mm-hmm. So Black Widow and Red Car are still driving around. She thought that Matt was trailing her for a while, but then realizes that he's gone, and now she feels alone and kind of betrayed. Which was weird. It was just like a odd moment. I mean, I guess maybe she doesn't know how she feels about him.
Yeah, she's conflicted. They're still, remember, they're just friends.
Yeah,
they're just friends.
They just moved in together in San Francisco where they're just friends. And she doesn't know what she wants.
Yeah.
And she doesn't know Matt Murdock very well yet. They've been on like an Alpine spy destruction robot ski vacation and this.
And a double-decker plane.
Yeah.
And a double-decker plane, lest we forget. Despite all the problems he was having pages ago, Daredevil's crushing it in this fight against the goons, and he wonders if he even needs his hypersenses, which is like a pretty supervillainy thing to say.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you always hear supervillains be like, "I don't even need my powers to crush you." Mm-hmm. And maybe Daredevil's just a bad guy. Maybe he's not actually a superhero.
He's not always a good guy.
He's definitely not. At this point, Kilgrave, the Purple Man, emerges from the fog, pulls a classic Kilgrave, and he has the civilians all attack the hero. A modern audience is like a little desensitized to this. It's like a little tropey, but back then it was probably like pretty terrifying. Like, that's a scary to have all these like mindless zombie people who you are there to help assault the, you know, the quote unquote good guy. So meanwhile, Widow meets French at a bar where he's being just kind of a shady dude. He's maybe making deals. And they quickly mention their concerns around something called Project 4, presumably the sequel project to Project 3. I feel like you can see Project 4.
It's the sequel to Factor 3.
Oh, there you go. So do you feel like you need to see Factor 3 before Project 3 before 4? Or is really just like Easter eggs?
They encapsulate it quite a bit in the you know, sort of the prologue. But
you just got to watch the crawl.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So before we find out any more about Project 4, we cut to a fireplace-chilling Ivan who's enjoying a nice night at home when the phone rings. It's not Matt, as he expected, but instead is Larry Cranston from the famous Roderick Sloan and Cranston. Intriguing. What does he want? Who knows?
We never because get to hearing know.
This, Ivan runs out of the house to find Matt. I assume that's a plot point that will be picked up soon.
Mm-hmm.
I also assume it has something to do with them repossessing the house. I don't know. That's my guess.
I do like this next cut, though.
Oh yeah. You mean meanwhile back on the flying saucer?
Yeah. I didn't know there was a flying saucer involved. And it just goes from Ivan being like, I'm bored, I need to do something, I just got a call from some law firm or something, I'm leaving. And to just immediately on the same page cut to like a flying saucer.
I love how like how little patience Gene Colan obviously has for any of the like fantastical or superhero elements of the story. Like everything else, like the interiors of these places, like and the exteriors and everything, like the setting is beautiful. The cars are perfectly rendered.
It's like researched phones and chairs and cars and
buildings. Everything about this is great. And then when he has to draw, it's like, now draw the getaway airship of the supervillains. He's like, it's a flying saucer.
And it's like cut out, like it's so the perspective is so close that most of it's cut out of the frame.
Yeah.
So you're only
it's
seeing,
mostly just Zipitone on it. And just
you're
there.
Seeing the middle bottom. Like, yeah. It's mostly well,
and,
just
and you look at like all the detailed rendering on the townhouse
behind
it. And then you just like, he basically drew like four circles. Like, we're done.
Right. Can I go home now?
And I just like, I don't know why I didn't remember Kilgrave had a flying saucer, or maybe he didn't.
I don't think he did.
Yeah.
There was no mention of the flying saucer that I recall. It just suddenly there's a flying saucer, you know, I thought they'd be in a truck. Nothing fancy.
Yep.
And then the next panel is from the top of the flying saucer, and you get a sense that the scale that you just assumed was there was completely wrong. Because, like, it seems like a classic flying saucer where you would go in it and you could fit hundreds of people in there, or at least 100. But then from the top perspective, there's, like, I don't know, 3, 4, 5 guys holding a 6 guy.
Yeah.
And that's all the room there is. It's more of like a platform.
Yep.
Very weird.
Yeah, it's pretty funny. And Kilgrave says something really interesting. He says, it was all I could do to keep those people from tearing Daredevil to ribbons once I ordered them to attack. Perhaps my powers of total command have grown in these intervening years, or perhaps people have grown subconsciously more vicious.
Yeah. That seemed like something that someone was saying.
Yep. A little from column A and column B, I think.
Yeah.
Yep.
So Daredevil is unconscious and the goons have him on top of this flying platform saucer. They slap him awake so that Kilgrave can explain that he was in prison for 2 years when the mist that dampened his powers somehow exploded something, so he escaped to San Francisco to build a criminal empire.
There you go. It's all you need.
Makes perfect sense.
Totally. But then Ivan shows up. He punches through a door, deploys tear gas, and rescues Daredevil so that they can rescue the Black Widow, who he assumes is in greater trouble than Daredevil was, for reasons. Ivan figured out that Daredevil was in trouble when the tracker showed him to be in a townhouse, an apparently evil townhouse. Take note, if you ever see your find your friends is pointing to a townhouse, you best go save your friends. So they punch the rest of the goons off the hovercraft. Ivan flies it. He hopes it's similar to the flying machines he's flown in the past. And Daredevil
in World
gets,
War II in Russia.
In World War II, right. Russian World War II. Flying saucers.
Right.
Daredevil's super upset because this is apparently the very first time that the man without fear has failed. And this obviously isn't true. He's failed lots of times.
Yeah,
he's a walking failure.
Remember when he fought Namor? That was best.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just laying in the street, grabbing at his ankle as he walks away.
Not to mention, all those times he failed at basic human dignity.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, I think even the Ghost Bones horse messed him up pretty badly.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, empathy, he's failed at a number of times.
Right. So the fighting stops, Daredevil's sad, and then we cut to two more frames, which is Black Widow and French walking very calmly through a parking lot.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of sort of moody narration. And the next issue cliffhanger is, what is Project 4? Like a sort of a weep womp ending there.
Yeah. I'll give you guys a little thing that helped spice up these last two Daredevil issues for
okay.
me.
Ooh.
Whenever the name Danny French comes up, I say Danny French in my head. And it like he's like Danny French. And that's how he says his name. And that's how everybody thinks of him. And then it makes it way more fun.
That is way more fun.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's the most I can do to help you out. And I haven't read forward, so I don't really know.
Do none of us know what Project 4 is?
No.
It's after 3 for sure, but...
Yeah.
Is it before 5?
Possibly.
You would think. Yeah.
It's before 4B.
Yeah. I just got to say, like, so far... So we've had, you know, 2 issues where Danny French has been teased here. Nothing is making me... like super interested in who he is or where this is going.
They went on that car chase at the beginning where he's like on 2 wheels careening into alleyways in San Francisco.
Sure.
And I've been through some crazy, some like taxi rides in San Francisco that took like 10 years.
Oh, we've all played crazy taxi.
Yeah.
Sure.
But, so I'm like, okay, we're going to find out. This guy's obviously, you know, running from her. It didn't even seem like when they met up that he knew he was being chased. He was just driving like an idiot.
Yeah.
Like, this is just how I drive my Mustang through San Francisco.
Yeah. And then she finds him in the bar and they're like, hi. Oh, hi.
Yeah.
And then, yeah. So I don't know. We'll see. We'll see where it goes. I'm withholding all judgment.
I like the Purple Man a lot. I think he's interesting.
Mm.
This may be, I hope that's not the end of him. Do you think that's it? Is that the end of his crime?
I'd be shocked if he didn't come back, but who knows?
This seems like a little tease, a Daredevil tease of what the Purple Man has in store.
Yeah, he didn't get to do much, and Daredevil didn't get to, you know, kind of get his win back. So,
well, and like, what's her name didn't appear again, the siren, lady. Yeah. So yeah, maybe there's more.
I feel like there's a lot of dangling plot threads here that hopefully will get resolved into something interesting. But
what happened to Chico the Goon?
Who knows?
Only time will tell.
Yeah. Well, if you didn't get enough Daredevil in that story, I have good news for you. He also shows up in Incredible Hulk number 152, which I'll tell you about right now. The story is called "But Who Will Judge the Hulk?" It is written by Gary Friedrich and Steve Englehart. The art is by Dick Ayers, Herb Trimpe, and Frank Giacoya. Dick Ayers is credited as the penciler, Frank Giacoya is the inker, and then there's a note saying there was an assist by Herb Trimpe and practically the whole bullpen.
This looks like one of the more slapdash things we've seen since that, like, Barry Windsor Smith showing up in Daredevil.
Yeah.
It was like, obviously, we've got 5 minutes to deadline. Draw this comic book.
Yeah, for sure. I did a little more digging in the Grand Comics database, and they said that Trimpe redrew many of the Hulk faces throughout the issue. He also redrew the caricatures of President Richard Nixon and Vice President Spiro Agnew, who also show up in this issue, and Daredevil and Black Widow on page 12. Other artists who likely assisted included John Verpoorten, John Romita, and Mike Esposito. So they really did bring everyone in on this.
Seems like such an ambitious, I mean, we'll get to the story, but like an ambitious story to end up just like not having any people, not having somebody to work on that.
Right. Well, and Steve Englehart is an uncredited co-writer on the story. This is something that only Gary Friedrich gets the credit, but Englehart definitely co-wrote or possibly wrote the story. So,
man, I love the kernel of the idea.
Sure.
The nugget.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm guessing that the craziness around all of this had to do with like holiday schedules or illness. I mean, they would have been working on this just before, like between like Thanksgiving and Christmas. That's my guess is that, you know, someone couldn't finish it for whatever reason and it wound up getting passed around a lot.
Because turkey.
Tryptophan, man. That's real.
I thought you meant the place, turkey.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, no. Sorry, turkey. The place.
there was another interesting note in the letters column, which does not appear in the Marvel Unlimited version. There is a letter asking a question that I have asked myself, and I just wondered about since we started doing this, but they asked why colorists aren't credited in any of these stories. And the answer that we're given is because coloring is the last stage in the production process before engraving the books, and the editor's schedule is so hectic, it's easier not to include the credit. So,
right.
Yeah. But they also go on to say that Marie Severin colors most of our covers and Mimi Gold is the regular colorist on the interior Hulk stories. So,
wow.
So there you go.
She was the one who wrote that one issue of
Iron Man, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah. Iron Man.
Yeah. That Iron Man issue.
Yep. I remember that issue.
Yeah. So yeah. Okay. So that's a little inside baseball, a little behind the scenes stuff. But let's get into the issue. It starts out, as so many issues do, with Hulk Smash Army. And if you look closely at the soldiers' helmets, though, you'll see that they say LMD. They are life model decoys. And where there are LMDs, there must be Nick Fury, who is watching the action from a bunker with General Ross and Captain America, who we are told is not working for S.H.I.E.L.D. at the moment, at Fury's orders. And there's very good tension between Cap and Fury. It's carried over really consistently from Cap's own book. And it's all handled in dialogue. Like, there's nothing in the art to suggest that these two have a problem with each other.
Right. But somebody came in editorially and said, they're not getting along in the book. So
yep,
we got to write some stuff here.
Exactly. Yeah. So,
it does make Cap look really passive aggressive though.
Yeah, it does. Yeah. Neither one of them comes off great, but,
which is nice. I mean, that's like a cool bit of characterization.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. General Ross orders in the Hulkbusters, which at this point in the series are jets armed with a paranet, which is an electrified net that is just barely powerful enough to shock the Hulk unconscious at maximum power. And that's exactly what they do. Ross orders the Hulk bound with titanium cables, and then he calls his best bud, Richard Nixon. Everybody take a drink. Jeez. To tell him that they have captured the Hulk. Nixon is giddy at the prospect of being able to prosecute the Hulk, which comes as a surprise to Ross. He did not know that Nixon was intending to prosecute him.
Like, what did he think? What did he think he's been doing for 190 issues?
His job is to execute orders from his commander in chief.
And Ross is busy just capturing the Hulk, trying to change him back or kill him, and him getting loose. Like, that's what he does.
Yeah.
He doesn't have like a legal plan involved, but Nixon, it's looking for a big PR win here.
Yep.
Yeah.
General Ross is like that Seinfeld joke where when they're taking the wanted photos, and it's like the wanted picture is them taking the picture, and then the side view of the face is them leaving as they're walking out. And it's like, why didn't you just hold on to the guy while you were taking his picture? Like, Ross perpetually capturing the Hulk.
Yep. Well, I mean, what else would he do with himself if he actually succeeded?
Probably turn colors.
Yeah. So a Hulk reverts to Bruce Banner, who they tranquilize and begin to transport back to Hulkbuster base. And Fury has had enough of standing near Cap, so he leaves, and Cap apologizes for Fury's behavior before taking his leave as well. Why were these guys even in the book? Like,
oh yeah, they did literally nothing.
They do nothing.
I think the plan in this book was get as many guest stars as possible.
I can see that.
Then question mark. And there we go. That's the kernel I was talking about, the nugget of the story.
Right. Yeah. Yep.
They might have scripted a fight scene between the two of them, but the budget on the planes just went way far over. So they had spent so much money on right. jets yeah. and
the,
electric stuff.
The
they just
paranet or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah, it's also possible. I mean, this story is the issue is split up into two halves. So we get into chapter two, which begins on page 11, and it's called Defender of the Doomed. I mean, it's possible that this second half of the story was a complete departure from what the original plan was. Maybe they didn't have it, you know, like maybe Fury and Cap were going to be more, you know, involved in capturing the Hulk or whatever. Mm-hmm. So, but yeah, I mean, they basically just stand around with General Ross, while the Hulk is fighting LMDs, which also didn't need to be LMDs either, you know?
Like, yeah. They didn't show him. Like, I think in a modern comic, they'd show Hulk rip somebody in half.
Right.
And then, then you'd get to know a couple panels later that it was LMDs.
Right, right.
Right.
Yep. Okay, so let's get into chapter two. Defender of the Doomed. Matt Murdock gets the call in San Francisco to defend the Hulk during his trial, and he accepts. This seems to be taking place right in the middle of DD's latest bout with Kilgrave. I would place it like right after Daredevil. The timing is a little strange, but just go with it. Mm. There's a lot of continuity holes in the story. There's only so much spackling we can do here. then we cut to the FF, who are reading that in a newspaper that the Hulk is to be charged with conspiracy to destroy public property and endanger human lives.
Conspiracy.
So we can assume that they have just wrapped up with Galactus.
Yes. Yeah. Yep. And I think the whole conspiracy charge, I think it is a tongue-in-cheek reference to what a lot of activists at the time were being charged with, especially like militant activists. So if you don't commit an actual violent crime or an actual property crime, you can still be charged with the conspiracy to commit that crime, which makes you legally liable for the crime.
Without having done the actual crime.
Without actually having done it. Yeah, exactly. It's something they brought in originally to prosecute organized crime. And it was used to, you know, used against militant groups. Englehart certainly was, he was a young guy. He was, you know, pretty progressive and into, you know, all sorts of, you know, youth movements of the day. So I wouldn't be surprised if that was just a little, you know, a little knife he was sticking in the ribs there. Mm-hmm. I do think it's kind of funny charging Marvel's most solitary character with conspiracy. And I do think that that's part of the joke of it, you know, is like, you know, wait, you're charging the Hulk with, like, who did he conspire with?
Right. He's the least conscious character, metaphorically and literally, that we have. Like, he's not doing anything on purpose, and he's asleep half the time.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And he has no friends to plan anything with.
Aww. Canonically, he has no
friends. Canonically, he has no friends. He keeps smashing them when they turn out to be robots. Ben and Johnny are delighted that the Hulk might be put away forever, but Reed encourages them to think about Bruce Banner, who was doomed to become the Hulk because of a freak accident. Reed is so persuasive that he manages to turn everyone around on the issue, and they all vow to help in any way they can.
I love that Reed's argument is sort of like scholarly elitism, though.
Yeah.
It's like, we'll lose the best gamma radiation physicist if Bruce Banner is imprisoned. I loved that one page was the greatest of this book, because it made you consider all of these things about the Hulk, about conspiracy to commit a crime, or to possibly endanger the public, whatever. And they were doing like both sidesing a political issue.
Yeah.
So just that one page seemed like, oh, this has got some legs.
That's pretty all right. Yeah.
I also think the line, it's hardly his fault that though a freak, through a freak accident, he was doomed to spend a horrible portion of his life as the Hulk. I like to read a little bit of guilt in that. Like, that's him trying to make good on guilt he feels about what he's done to his best friend.
That's Reed looking around at his Rocky buddy and all the other mutations he's caused in his family.
Right.
Yep. Yeah. speaking of helping, one person who really isn't helping at all is Matt Murdock, who is flying on the plane that's transporting the heavily sedated Bruce Banner and a bunch of soldiers. Murdock demands that Ross reduce the amount of sedation that Banner is being given. Ross quite rightly responds that that would be a great way to have Banner turn into the Hulk at 40,000 feet and kill them all. And Murdock threatens to put in a call to the Attorney General and says that he'll have any conviction that the government gets overturned if they continue violating Banner's civil rights. And this is one of those situations where it's like, yes, I mean, he's not wrong, but
you should probably secure
Can you just wait until we're on the ground?
Right.
You know,
it's like, yeah, also there's a difference between not sedating and stimulant.
Yeah.
Yep.
Not like, and also not sedating Bruce Banner is like giving a normal, giant, insane person PCP,
right?
You know, like
right,
or bath salts. I don't know, something terrible, and
or taking a psychotic person off of their antipsychotics,
right?
Yeah,
right.
yeah.
I do like, though, under sedation, Bruce Banner is pretty much suicidal.
Oh yeah,
he's like, very much so. I think it would. It might be cool to just, if they give me the chair, it would be a relief. He's just, he's like, and that is a part of Bruce Banner's character that I think is awesome, that they shine. Just like how just tired and suicidal that he is.
Yeah, yeah,
Because of just all of the pain, and he just has to deal with everything he does when he's the Hulk, and hates it, and is
completely ruined his life.
He's exhausted.
Yeah. You know, Ross, he gives in, he doesn't want to run the risk of the government losing the conviction that it might get over Banner. So he orders Banner to be given a stimulant. And guess what happens? Like, just go ahead and guess what happens.
Everything's fine, and he has a discourse with his attorney.
Oh man! Even Banner tells Murdoch that it was a dumb decision. As soon as the stimulant starts hitting him and his head clears, he's like, "Why did you do that? This is a terrible idea." He starts sweating buckets. He demands to be sedated again. But it's too late. Banner hulks out on the plane. And everything starts going to hell, but Murdoch steps forward and starts calmly speaking to the Hulk, which calms the Hulk down.
Talks about being his friend.
Yeah.
That's the Hulk's, like, all you have to do is walk up to Hulk going, friend, and you probably won't get smashed.
Immediately. Yeah,
forget that sun's going down business. What does that even, mean? That doesn't mean anything.
Hulk even takes Murdoch's hand and he shakes it as the plane comes in safely for a landing. Then Ross barges in and says, "We're down, Murdoch. Now get the devil out of here and let S.H.I.E.L.D. handle that monster. You did a great job, but it's finished now." So Hulk immediately assumes that Murdoch is trying to trick him. He tears through the side of the plane where a bunch of tanks and the Fantastic Four are ready to intercept him. And that is where this issue ends. And like, boy, there's a lot of unforced errors in that second chapter.
Yes.
It's just like, this, I mean, I understand, you know, you create situations for dramatic effect, but I feel like everyone could have maybe handled that better.
Right.
Agreed.
Like, I was so excited about after the dumb sedation stimulant thing, for Matt Murdock to be like just a voice of reason, you know, and talk to the Hulk.
Right.
And I was like, you know, Matt Murdock might be fairly well suited since he's like a guy who just is compelled to go beat up people.
Right.
Mm-hmm. He might be able to have a actual conversation with the Hulk and maybe defend the Hulk. So I was in my brain, it was going into this sweet version of the thing where the Hulk sits down, they land, the Hulk goes to court. It was going to be like She-Hulk, you know, just the Hulk behaves, but he's still the Hulk. And
the Hulk wearing a little suit.
Yeah. And Matt Murdock like had just talked him down into this, but then immediately the same trope that always happens.
Yeah.
And Hulk smash plane.
Yep.
You got to wonder when they're in that room, are they asking themselves like, we're not going to do this thing again, are we? Like where we, you know, he calms down and then he freaks out. And like, are they looking for a way not to do that? Or are they just like, no, this is the thing we do. Like we can't not do it.
Yeah. Somebody bursts in and says, it's got to go to print tomorrow.
Yeah. Right. I always forget the pacing problem.
Yeah. Yeah.
Of their lives, not the comic.
Right. Yeah. Well, one leads to the other.
Sure.
So that's the comics that we're going to talk about this month. The only thing left to do now is to share our astonishing takes, our recommendations for things that our listeners might want to check out that are not Marvel comics from March of 1972. My recommendation this week is Imposter Syndrome by David F. Walker. So this is a collection of short story comics by hometown hero David Walker. He describes it as a cross between A Cry for Help and Exorcism of the Demons That Haunt Me. And some of it is very personal and very intense, but It's also way funnier than you might assume. He clearly is a guy who believes in laughing at the things that scare and upset you. And the result is a collection of stories from across his career that have weight and substance to them, but never feel like, you know, self-indulgent. Just really accessible and really, really compelling stuff. And there is one true to life Harlan Ellison story that happened to/near David. And, you know, I think I made it clear what my opinion of Harlan Ellison as a person is. I'm just going to say this story did nothing whatsoever to change that opinion. So for that reason alone, you should totally buy this thing and read it. It's great.
We were at Rose City and you were talking with David Walker about this and you mentioned this Harlan Ellison story and I just bought the book sight unseen. Like I was like, oh, there's a, he alluded to what it was like. And then, we also met one of the artists of the stories and we had a, you know, I got the book signed and I still haven't read it yet. So now I'm, because I've been going through other stuff I bought at Rose City, but, yeah. And which is where I'm headed. I'm going to recommend Phenomena, The Golden City of Eyes by Brian Michael Bendis.
I know that guy.
And Andre Lema Araujo. I'm really bad at
nailed
Portuguese.
It.
I mean, so, one of those definitely has to be it, right?
Araujo.
Not necessarily.
Araujo. Araujo. I think that's it.
We're sorry.
Portuguese is a beautiful language that I cannot even ever get to work out for me.
Portuguese is a beautiful language, but we are all ugly people.
Nice.
So I just got it at from Bendis at Rose City, and I had seen some preview teasers in his Substack, and it's so fun. It's so much more fun than I thought it was going to be. It's the best part for me is that although it is a fantasy style epic quest, it is one of those lovely pairings of sci-fi and fantasy. You know, where the science is sort of so forgotten that it's pretty much magic, and or maybe both things coexist. And it's an almost post-apocalyptic story. So it's got a nice twist to that, too. And I won't give away too much about the actual story, but it reminded me a lot of the Inkle over and over again, but with a little more coherence, richer characters, and better pacing to the action. It had like a Talisman feel from Stephen King too, which is like a thing. It's like when there's a kid involved and they're on this quest by themselves, it's like there's always, which is the root of this story. It's always really interesting to, but a warning for Jamie, it is in black and white. Which I get, but I have totally shaken loose of that requirement for my comics pretty much since the time we've done the podcast. I've read a lot of black and white comics in the past, but I was always like, if I had to choose between black and white and color, I'm like, color. I don't, even if it's crappier.
Then, this is like fine line black and white. That's a different animal.
It is very fine line. But now I'm like, I have no... If the story's good or if there's promise in the creators, I don't care if there's color.
God, yeah, this is beautiful. Holy cow!
Yeah, it's a great story, and the, of course they're Bendis characters. They have each they're well-rounded characters. They have the hilarious things they say and interactions, even in a world where they say things that don't make any sense to you because it's a different world entirely, sort of.
Very nice.
Sort of.
All right. I've got Luda by Grant Morrison. This book is crazy. It's not for everyone. It's very explicit. It is super queer. It's very literary or languagey. There are a lot of words. Like we were talking about it over Slack and I was like, oh, I'm just going to post, there was like a sentence. I was like, oh, maybe I'll share a sentence of this book. And like, I couldn't capture it because it just, it kept going. The sentences are huge. it's another one of those things where you're not always sure like what's a metaphor and what's really happening, which it seems like a thing that is happening more and more these days, which I really enjoy. I'm about halfway through it so far. So here's the general premise. So Lucy LeBang is a big drag star kind of at the tail end of her career. And she's in either a play / drag cabaret version of Aladdin, or it's a play about people putting on a play of Aladdin where people start getting murdered. But then her co-stars start actually getting murdered. And then there enters this captivating newcomer, Luda, who Lucy takes on as sort of a protege of sorts. And from there, things just get crazy. Like, it's very psychedelic. It's very meta. Like I said, it's very queer, very explicit. But it's also a ton of fun. There's a lot of metaphorical magic, but also I think maybe non-metaphorical magic. And I think maybe that if it is literal magic, it might be fueled by sex and drugs in a literal way. But I'm not totally sure yet. Like I said, I'm only halfway through.
It sounds like an excellent Grant Morrison novel.
Yeah, I like doped my way into. I was like, oh, I just need a quick book. Like I'll grab. And this Grant Morrison book looks big, but I'm sure how could it? It couldn't possibly be dense and 17 layers of things on top of each other. I was like, ooh, yeah.
I had it and was about to start reading it and realized that I had a friend who needed it as a birthday gift more than I needed it right now. So I gifted it away before I could get into that, but I'll get another copy. You know,
we bought ours on the same day, it turns out.
Yeah. Yeah. You were just after me.
Yep. Books with pictures. As always. Yeah. So nice. I mean, anyone who's into those things should check it out. It's a wild ride.
I am. And I will.
Excellent. All right. Well, hey, we made it to the end of another episode.
Yeah.
That's pretty good, right? We got that going for us.
Especially for the lackluster comics we had.
Cool. Yeah. Yeah. Well, thank you so much for listening and for sticking with us all the way to the end. If for some reason you want to hear more of this episode than is on the public version, you can subscribe to our Patreon for the fantastic price of $4 a month at patreon.com/MarvelByTheMonth. And get exclusive content. You could also listen to like 59 other episodes that are probably higher energy.
Made a lot of jokes though, man.
Yeah, we pulled, you know, we pulled out. Yeah,
solid amount of joke content.
Yeah.
Our JPM was high. Our jokes per minute. Jabs.
Japes.
None of this works.
None of it works. You can review us on Apple Podcasts or whatever you use to listen to us. If you'd like some free stuff in the mail, send us a screenshot of your 5-star review to marvelbythemonth@gmail.com. Find us on Instagram at marvelbythemonth, and marvelbythemonth.com has links to our other social channels as well as our shop. That's all for now. My name is Brian Stratton.
Mine is Rob Milne.
And I'm Jamie Japes Wenger.
We'll see you next week for something pretty cool, hopefully. Until then, stay safe, stay healthy, and stay inside and read comics.